Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson. Move Over Campaign Trail. This week's lead is a combination of The Amazing Race meets Survivor meets what are those contests where whoever keeps their hand on the car the longest wins the car? The filing period for elected office in South Carolina has closed and the field is set, with many candidates facing June primary challengers or none at all. This year, the governor, constitutional officers, the state's seven congressmen, all 124 seats in the State House of Representatives, and dozens of local positions are up for election. So join us as we take a look at these races. We hope you're interested because this week's show is about a core tenet of democracy, voting. If you're a first-time listener, welcome to our podcast. If you're a veteran leader, welcome back, you old scallywag. I'm guessing democracy interests you enough to listen to all four sections of our podcast instead of trying to explain podcasts to your relatives or while you write out sugar withdrawals from Easter or double down on half-price candy. Hashtag life hack. And now, quorum call. Chocolate! Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Oh, wait a minute. Wait, we don't have a quorum call this week? For once, we haven't buried the lead? We're not burying the lead this week? Oh, wait. No, I'm getting a note now. It says that this is an April Fool's joke, and I can't believe you fell for that, Gavin. Ha, 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 ha. And it just goes on like this. Got that from my producer. Okay, well, it turns out we do have some news this week for you. Number one, SC&G customers are closer to getting rate cuts for the failed VC Summer nuclear project. The Post and Courier reports that the Senate voted 26-16 last week to amend a joint resolution that would slash rates by 13%. That's the amount a consultant study said would not harm SC&G's parent company, Scana. Now, the House version cuts the entire 18% of monthly bills targeted for the nuclear project. A separate study conducted by the state's utility watchdog found that Scana could withstand losing that money by ending dividends to its stock investors. Now, the General Assembly has pledged to help SC&G customers in the wake of what's widely considered the state's worst business failure after SC&G and its partner, the state-run Santee Cooper, sank $9 billion into the project. Now, it's worth noting that the governor said he won't sign a bill unless rates go to zero. While the Senate amended the bill, it did not give it the necessary second or third readings yet to send it back to the House for concurrence. Number two, staying with utility news, the Associated Press reports that Governor Henry McMaster said it's, quote, egregious, quote, that Santee Cooper, a state-owned utility, lobbied against its own sale following that multi-billion-dollar nuclear construction debacle. McMaster called upon Santee Cooper to halt its lobbying efforts. Shortly after the $9 billion project failure last summer, the governor began trying to recruit someone to buy the utility, which provides electricity to the state's electric cooperatives. McMaster has said he could recoup some of the $4 billion Santee Cooper sunk into the project by selling the utility and potentially getting the buyer to restart construction of the reactors. Santee Cooper, however, hired lobbyists to tamp down support for any sale. Its customers currently pay about $5 a month for the nuclear project. Number three, South Carolina took a step closer to becoming the latest state to allow the legalization of marijuana for treatment of critically ill patients, according to the Associated Press. Although the bill's sponsor, Senator Tom Davis, acknowledged it's not likely to become law this year. The Senate Medical Affairs Committee last week narrowly approved a bill that would allow the use of medical marijuana to treat some critically ill patients. It now goes to the full Senate. But Davis said he knows it won't get ultimate approval this legislative year, which wraps up in May. Now, if South Carolina were to pass this measure into law, it would be among the most restrictive medical marijuana laws in the country. The version of the bill approved Thursday would explicitly make it illegal to smoke medicinal marijuana and lays out a number of requirements for prescribing physicians and operators of medical cannabis dispensaries. And number four, the Statehouse report finds that this year's proposed general fund budget is still underfunding education in South Carolina by hundreds of millions of dollars, despite education being a top priority of voters and lawmakers. State law requires per student funding to be $2,959 a year. The current funding is $2,425 a year. However, in the current budget as drafted by the Senate right now, it only increases the base student cost by $60. So if lawmakers do boost it by $60, student funding would still be short $345 million of what the law requires. All right, I need your attention right now. Before we get into this, our lead this week is going to be a campaign trail on steroids, people. Okay, I know what you're saying, but Gavin, we have been on the campaign trail like the whole time. But folks, there's on the trail and then there's on the trail. And we are on the trail. You know what I mean? Filing is complete for elected office in South Carolina and the stage is set. You can hear me salivating right now. I'm like Daffy Duck over here. But what is going to happen? Will a blue wave crash over the Palmetto State? Or will Republicans maintain control of the historically red state? Well, to find out and get some insight, we have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove back with us to break down what we saw with filing last week and where things go from here. Jamie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
South Carolina's elections are settled during the primaries. It's sad but true that's how our political system works for the most part. That assumption is not from a political insider, rather the political norm of such a Republican state such as ours. No Democrats have held statewide elected office for years, and in the 2016 election, 1.1 million South Carolinians voted for Donald Trump compared to 855,000 Democrats for Hillary Clinton. So we're a Republican state, but that doesn't mean Democrats aren't running or that there haven't been close calls, such as what we saw last year in the special election for the 5th Congressional District. But that was a special election race, and that draws a different crowd than primaries, which is different from general elections in midterm years, like this year, especially when you can easily vote straight ticket. So, to break down the races for governor, constitutional officers, the 7 congressional races, and more, we got political campaign trail guide Jamie Lovegrove here to talk about the twists and turns of the campaign trail back in the studio. So, Jamie, are Republicans set to stay strong this year? Are they going to take away from any Democrats or give up any to any of the Democrats?
Yeah, well, Gavin, we do always hear about this quote-unquote blue wave, it's particularly in, you know, the first midterm of a new president. You do typically see the party that is out of power do particularly well around the country. The fact of the matter is that in South Carolina, the way that the map is drawn, the way that the state has, you know, remained fairly similar demographically over the years, it's just not quite as likely to hit here as it is in other parts of the country. Even in other red states, Georgia, Texas, Democrats have been a lot more hopeful about their chances in states like that because of demographic changes, because of the way the state operates. But, you know, you look at a state house map here, there's a Democratic group based in Washington called Every District. They ran data in every single legislative district all over the country, every single state legislative district, from the 2016 and 2012 presidential elections. And what they found in South Carolina was there are three Republican-held state house seats that are within 10%. So every single other state house seat in South Carolina that is held by a Republican has a more than 10% Republican advantage. That's a very, very hard margin to overcome, even in a very, very strong year for Democrats. So that's why it's hard to envision it really hitting particularly strongly in South Carolina.
And we're talking about the State House of Representatives here in Columbia. And right now, you know, there are 124 State House Representatives. I already said that. But of those 124, 79 are Republicans. So a very strong, solid Republican hold on the State House of Representatives. And even, you know, we're talking about three. That's not enough to even sway any majority there.
But absolutely not.
It kind of just shows, you know, what the situation is in South Carolina. And again, we're not pushing either side here. We're just breaking down the matter of fact. And we're looking at the data to show that, you know, while there might be some pushes in other parts of the country, South Carolina is still a solid red state at the local level to the state level.
Now, look, there's a lot of optimism on the Democratic side, and they're going to be pushing in seats that they have not competed in for a very, very long time. There's one particular seat way up in Oconee in the sort of Republican heartland of the upstate, Bill Sandifer's seat. There's a candidate running against him named Jody Golan, who Democrats are really excited about. They say she's a very, very strong candidate. Now, according to Every District's data, that is a R plus 30 districts. So that is a district where Republicans have a 30% advantage. Oh. It is hard to imagine what could possibly happen to take down a longstanding incumbent in an R plus 30 district like Representative Sandifer. Now, there are some Republicans who really don't like Representative Sandifer as well. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of his colleagues
and that's the thing.
Go up there and campaign against him. But again, you know, those are the kind of seats if they were going to make any sort of major inroads in the state house specifically, you know, it's hard to imagine seats like that really going blue.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. It's not like we're seeing millions of dollars in House races in the state, mm-hmm. at least. You know, I do remember last year, 2016, rather, when, you know, there was a very contentious fight for Senator Leatherman's seat. Now, that was millions of dollars in that race. But for the most part, in the House races, even in the Senate races, you don't see millions of dollars coming in. So that's the kind of thing that really does sway these things, for the most part, when it comes to changing mm-hmm. some of these districts. So we can kind of say that, barring major events, I mean— yeah. That's how things will go. The
right.
status quo sometimes remains.
Democrats are also excited. They have a lot of candidates.
True.
You know, they have, I think, overall, in all offices, there's 353 Democratic candidates. I think there was 390-something, 99 mm-hmm. Republican candidates all over the state, all levels. But Democrats have something like 30 Republican seats they have challengers for, mm-hmm. which is an unusually high number. There aren't that many Republican challengers in Democratic-held seats. So, you know, you've got a candidate on the ballot. That's better than nothing. Republicans, on Friday, we saw a little bit of gloating from the chairman of the state party, Drew McKissick. You know, he was pointing out that Democrats had not found a candidate to run in District 42, mm-hmm. Which has been held by a Democrat since at least 2003, mm-hmm. I believe, was when Representative Mike Anthony joined the legislature. He's retiring this year, and they did not find a Democratic candidate in that district to replace him. Now, what the Democrats will point out is that that is a Republican district that happened to be held by a Democrat because of the fact that Mike Anthony is very, very popular in that district.
Yeah,
he's a
County.
Local figure. He's an athletic director. He was just a very popular guy in Union County, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, the fact of the matter is that in most presidential years, that's been a seriously Republican county. It's just the fact that it was held by Mike Anthony.
Yeah, we did see those interesting words from Drew McKissick. A little bit different tone, but that's, you know, that's the politics of South Carolina.
Right.
And kind of going back to this freebie notion here, we do have two statewide offices in South Carolina that the Agriculture Commissioner and Comptroller General, those are both held by Hugh Weathers and
Richard Ekstrom.
Yep. Like, he signs my checks. you know, not the sexiest positions, but I mean, you see Hugh Weathers' name at the gas pump. You know, like, you know, he's been certified, and you know, he's obviously over agriculture in the state, which is our number one industry in the state. So a very big position there. But again, nothing too controversial or something that would draw a challenger per se compared to what you're seeing with like the Secretary of State's race with
Certainly,
Hammond and multiple candidates there.
Right.
So,
and you have a Democrat there, Melvin Wittenberg, mm-hmm. who Democrats are fairly excited about too. You know, that was another point that Chairman McKissick was bringing up on Friday, and several other Republicans I saw mentioning. You know, there was a line I think somebody said, you know, how can you be a serious major statewide political party if you can't fill out the statewide ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a point there. I mean, look, the fact of the matter is that I believe Agriculture Commissioner is only elected in 12 states.
Yeah.
Comptroller General, I think, is only elected in 9 states. There is actually not an elected Democratic Agriculture Commissioner in the country. So, you know, look, congratulations to Richard Ekstrom on winning re-election.
Yes.
He faces no opponents at all. I think that Hugh Weathers does face like a Green Party candidate or something like that. So, you know, he'll face some nominal challenge there. You know, look, as of Wednesday or Thursday, Democrats didn't have a candidate for attorney general. That would have been a much, much more serious problem to be dealing with. That's going to be, you know, the second billing statewide position this year because the lieutenant governor being on the same ticket as the governor. You know, if they had not had a candidate for that, that would have been a serious point to brew. They found one in Constance Nastopulo, who's a law professor down in Charleston. So they have someone to run for that now. And my sources tell me she'll be pretty well funded. She, you know, has the resources. She hosted a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So they found someone there. They didn't find someone for Agriculture Commissioner and Comptroller General, but you could have had a lot bigger problems.
You know, any office counts for some of these folks, and that's what they're trying to do with this, at least in other parts of the country, with the blue wave type notion. But again, no Democrats in South Carolina hold statewide elected office, and I don't think that's expected to change anytime soon, barring any major developments in any situations.
You know, look, the Democrats are also excited about the governor's race. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, tends to be a top of the ticket situation where you're most likely to get an upset victory. Mm-hmm. You know, James Smith is State Representative James Smith from Columbia is a candidate they've wanted to run for governor for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, he has some pretty strong challengers in the Democratic primary from Phil Noble, a Charleston businessman, and Marguerite Willis, a Florence antitrust attorney, mm-hmm. Who just last week named her running mate, State Senator John Scott from mm-hmm. Columbia. So, you know, that's a competitive race, too. But they do feel good about their chances of pulling an upset there.
Yeah, so all five Republicans and all three Democrats that we've been watching for the governor's race have filed. They're all in. And we saw the addition of an American Party candidate. but we're not going to really worry about that until after the primaries, until we get to the general. Obviously, he's not going to be in any of the primary debates that we have scheduled. But right now, it's kind of where we are. We saw Yancey McGill, former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill, who was a Democrat, now running as a Republican, kind of filed last minute.
He did file, though.
he was like the first to announce.
There was
but
some
then,
questions.
Yeah. And I want to just recap. We're still talking with Jamie Lovegrove from the Post and Courier. We're talking about all things campaign right now. It's a little bit of a longer episode, but people have been dying to know what's going on with the campaign trail and the races coming up. I know I've had several people ask me about what's going on, so we wanted to save a lot. Since filing closed last Friday, we now know who's in the race, who's not in the race, races statewide. And looking, switching gears to congressional districts, I think a big race to watch, and this is something we've kind of known about for some time now, is that 4th congressional district race.
Absolutely.
For Trey Gowdy's seat. He's retiring after being up in Congress for a while. He's not a big fan of Congress, so it was no secret that he was trying to get out. But right now, you know, he covers the Spartanburg-Greenville counties in that district, in the 4th district. And it's drawn 19 challengers. And I know Jamie had a tweet. If you don't follow Jamie on Twitter, you should do so at JS Lovegrove. Because he had a good tweet the other day. It's like, we should be looking at who hasn't filed, essentially.
Yeah, right.
Because, I mean, we
Greenville Spartanburg residents who haven't filed at this point the list is getting small.
We have 13 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and an American Party member running for this seat. You know, some of the Republicans we have seen coming is some state lawmakers,
yep.
Dan Hamilton and
William Timms.
And then we also have former state senator Lee Bright jumped in the race. We saw Reverend Mark Burns get in the race.
Yep.
Jamie, you've been following this race. You've been going to these campaign announcements.
Yeah.
Is this one of the most interesting races to watch? Or what is making this race just so popular, at least among candidates
Absolutely.
At this point?
Absolutely. Look, you know, I've said this before, that the most popular parlor game in Greenville politics for years, since Trey Gowdy got to Congress in 2010, has been who's going to replace Trey Gowdy when he leaves.
Yeah.
You know, folks didn't expect him to hang around. I don't think they expected him to leave this year. But mm-hmm. Look, he made that decision. You know, as I've recounted before, within 2 hours, we had about 3 or 4 candidates already jumped in.
I remember that day.
You know, here we are a couple months later, and we have, as you say, you know, 19 candidates from all these parties.
Yeah.
But 12 Republicans. Is it 12 Republicans?
13 Republicans.
Can't even keep count.
No, then that's valid. I'm not going to fault you for that.
Look, I think what's really, really interesting about the 4th congressional primary is Greenville, Spartanburg are sort of counties in the state that are very much the sort of old school, have been seen as very much the sort of old school conservatism, very family values, pro-business. You know, these are counties mm-hmm. that have really grown and thrived over the last few years. The question for me is going to be, is your typical candidate that does very well in that district, your state representative Dan Hamilton, mm-hmm. your state senator William Timmons, folks like that, Spartanburg, GOP chairman Josh Kimbrell, the sort of classically conservative 4th district candidate, they're going up against these sort of very Trumpian candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You're going up against Pastor Mark Burns, who was on the campaign trail for Trump, you know, spoke at the RNC convention. You're going against Lee Bright, you know, who was a bomb thrower when he was in the state Senate.
Wow.
He's someone who, you know, auctions off AR-15s. You know, he's very in your face. You've got folks like James Epley, who was the upstate field director for Trump's presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got some ties in the grassroots of Trump's network as well. So you got that group of folks. You got them running against the sort of classically conservative Dan Hamilton's William Timmons. And I'll be very interested to see whether this district maintains its sort of reputation or whether it is now just as Trumpian as many other Republican districts all over the country, and whether it's going to go for someone more in that kind of mold.
And kind of speaking about the Trumpian effect, we have seen that there are two out of the seven congressional members. Obviously, we have out of our seven congressional members in the delegation, six of them are Republicans. Mm-hmm. Our one lone Democrat is Representative James Clyburn in the Orangeburg area, the Midlands area. Mm-hmm. But what we have seen is that there are two Republicans being challenged in the primaries, Representative Tom Rice from the 7th Congressional District, the PD area, and then obviously Representative Mark Sanford down in District 1 in the Charleston area. They're both facing primary opposition. And have you been able to gather, I know some about the District 1 race, but have you been able to gather anything about whether this is some of that Trumpian effect or whether it's just maybe people saying we just want to get rid of the incumbents and start new?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the District 7 challenger. I believe his name's Larry Guy Hammond.
Yeah.
He's not as serious of a candidate, I think, as Katie Arrington is down in the Charleston area. Mm-hmm. Katie Arrington, who is a state representative, you know, has the support of a lot of other state lawmakers, mostly because, you know, there's still a lot of lingering animosity towards Congressman Sanford from his time as governor. You know, there's a very famous pig incident in the State House when he brought
pork
pigs
and barrel
to signify the pork that was getting loaded up in a lot of these legislations, or what is known as pork, sort of spending in certain areas around the state. There's a lot of animosity towards him for that. So as a result, you saw when Katie Arrington kicked off her campaign, House Majority Leader Gary Simrell, House Speaker Jay Lucas, they went down there. They've contributed to her campaign. They've been supporting her, so she can have some support there. She is challenging Mark Sanford from that Trumpian, I guess from the right, you could say. But, you know, it's hard to define it on the sort of ideological spectrum because Mark Sanford is a very conservative guy. But he has not necessarily always been deferential to President Trump.
Yeah.
And he has raised concerns about him. Katie Arrington is one of these challengers you're seeing all over the country in sort of Republican districts where they have not embraced Trump, of folks who are coming in and saying, you have to support the president's agenda. That's what I'm going to do. And so that's how she's challenging him there. And we'll get to the general eventually. And Joe Cunningham, the Democrat down there, you know, Democrats feel very strongly that they have a good candidate there. And interestingly, a very little noticed development, but the Cook Political Report actually moved the first district from safe Republican to likely Republican last week. Just a sign that there's sort of glimmers of life there, and an indication that maybe we'll have a more competitive race than we have had recently.
And Toby Smith was also a Democrat that jumped in that race too as a candidate. So there will be a Democratic primary for the first congressional district as well as the 7th congressional district. There's four Democrats going for that.
There are.
So there's a lot of that's the most we've seen since essentially that district was formed.
Yeah, and I'm still kind of trying to figure out what exactly is going on in the 7th District primary. You had State Representative Rob Williams get in there. You know, one would assume that state lawmakers, you know, have a decent chance in an open primary. I know that Bill Hopkins, who is an attorney, he has the support of Bakari Sellers. Bakari Sellers endorsed him shortly after he got into the race. So, you know, it could be an interesting race out there. I think you have some return candidates from previous elections out there too. Mal Hyman, who I'm pretty sure was the Democratic nominee in 2016. Against Congressman Rice. So it could be an interesting race out there
so
in PD.
Somewhat of that, you know, pushing that push, I mean, with this number of candidates going in for this congressional race, you know, we're maybe seeing that maybe be more of the blue wave attempt at that level, the congressional level, than versus so much at the state house level at that point.
Yeah.
And that's
something that's still
to be determined.
Both of them are going to be tricky, right? I mean, these are both. What the Democrats will, of course, point to is gerrymandering, is the way that the districting is done by the Republican-controlled legislature in 2011, made it, you know, sort of drew the map such that it made it very hard for Democrats to pick up a lot of seats. But the fact of the matter is that whoever you blame for the situation we're in, it is the situation we're in. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it's going to be difficult for Democrats to pick up a lot, even if the party has a very strong year nationally.
Gotcha.
That, you know, nothing's impossible, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we are covering this for you week
exactly.
in, week out. Jamie's doing it day in, day out for the Post and Courier. And we're keeping you up on this because, like we said, the primary is June 12th. So
yes,
a lot will be decided at the primaries. And then they go on for the final race down to November. Jamie, thank you for joining us this week. I know we didn't have time to talk about our big tent news dealing with that 5th Congressional District Democratic candidate, Steve Lowe. who's running as he's a former Ringling Brothers clown who's also in that race with several other
Archie Parnell, who's,
Archie Parnell,
of course, raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, a very serious candidate, can't get nearly as much press as Steve Lau the Clown did over the past week.
Yeah, but, you saw that dominate the headlines last week.
Such is the news business.
Yes, yes, you know, that's what it is. So, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us again, and we look forward to following the race with you going
Absolutely.
Forward.
Thanks, Gavin. Appreciate it.
We got on the campaign trail early this week, but that doesn't mean we don't have more news for you about it. Because like we said, we're officially on the trail, even though we've been on the trail. Just wanted to quickly note some new gubernatorial polling numbers that found Governor Henry McMaster with 41% support, according to a new Save the Children Action Network poll provided to the state newspaper. That would draw McMaster into a runoff, but Mount Pleasant attorney Catherine Templeton, who was in second, only had 10%. Others were within 5% or below, and 35% of people who were surveyed were undecided. Now, that's interesting to note because over on the Democratic side, 57% of Democrats were undecided on their field of three candidates, with Columbia Representative James Smith eking out an 18% lead. Florence attorney Marguerite Willis was at 11%, and rounding out the top three, Charleston businessman Phil Noble was at 7%. So, a lot can happen, a lot of undecided voters. So, poll numbers, either you love them, you hate them, the South Carolina lead has no allegiance to them other than to tell you about them. But it's not a popularity contest. Do your research on candidates, check them out, follow the news, and watch the debates. Oh, and also, make sure you vote. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know what sine die means? You might have seen it, might have heard it, but it's spelled S-I-N-E space D-I-E. Now, it's not common just to South Carolina. It's actually common to the legislative process itself, and its actual definition is without any future date being designated. So this term is used to note the end of the legislative session, which in South Carolina is this coming May 10th. So you may hear me say it or reference it on this show or on my YouTube video recaps of the State House, which I do every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday on SCTV's YouTube page. Definitely check those out if you haven't already. Now, unlike lawmakers in some states that throw confetti like they do in Georgia or have pages stack boxes in the State House, which was now outlawed in Iowa, or even down in Florida where the sergeant-at-arms both meet in the lobby and drop handkerchiefs, also known as dropping of the hanky in Florida, the Senate president and the House speaker in South Carolina just hit their gavels come 5 p.m. on sine die, and that's it until the second Tuesday in January. Now, lawmakers typically return to take up budget vetoes by the governor, and every so often they meet for a special session after adjourning on sine die. Now, there was almost a special session last year following the VC Summer project that fell apart, and there could possibly be one this summer should there be no resolution on key nuclear reform measures. We're still in a wait-and-see mode with that because no one knows how that's quite going to shake out yet. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Watch my State House video recaps every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday live at 7 p.m. on SCETV's Facebook page, our YouTube page, and my Twitter account at Gavin Jackson. Read the State House Daybook on SCETV.org and listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy to use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at @SCLEDEPOD and check out our photos from the studio and around the State House. We're also on Twitter at @SCLEDPOD. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE@SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on April 2nd, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Chocolate!
Yay!